Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Nicole Roussel, sitting in for John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, James Mad Dog Mattis is in Europe today meeting with European powers. What's he there for? According to one Newsweek headline, quote, Trump administration tells NATO prepare for Russian attack with planes, ships, and troops. Next, former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe has requested from Senator Chuck Grassley immunity from prosecution in exchange for testifying in front of a congressional hearing. Then, yesterday, Tuesday, June 5th, was a big day for the midterms. There were primaries in 8 states, including 5 gubernatorial primaries and House races across California. And then, Turkey and the U.S. struck a deal this week over the Syrian Kurdish People's Protection Units, the YPG. Turkey has long wanted YPG out of Manbij and threatened to continue its offensive in Afrin and push it east to Manbij. But this week, the two countries have agreed that YPG will leave the area. And finally, Sessions defended the Trump administration's policy yesterday of separating families at the border, saying, quote, if people don't want to be separated from their children, they should not bring them with them. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
And now we turn to the visit by James Mattis, Secretary of Defense, to Europe, where he's meeting with NATO countries. What is he there for? According to one Newsweek headline, quote, Trump administration tells NATO prepare for Russia attack with planes, ships, and troops. That's right. The U.S. government, represented by James Mattis, Secretary of Defense, is telling Europe prepare for war with Russia. We are joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. Welcome back, Mark.
Brian, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Likewise, thank you so much for joining us. What about this headline? Trump administration tells NATO prepare for Russian attacks with planes, ships, and troops. It sounds like something imminent, but of course that's not true. But certainly nonetheless, it creates a climate of extreme animus towards Russia and preparedness, or at least trying to prepare public opinion in America or whoever reads Newsweek for a possible confrontation.
Yeah, it is indeed a bit of worrying saber rattling. It's coming at a very unusual time. The Trump administration, which has previously laid down the law and in very harsh terms demanded that European countries spend more money on their defense to face the Russian threat, primarily Germany, but others, as the majority of NATO members, are not meeting the 2% mandatory defense spending that has been informally agreed upon by NATO members. Obviously, they do not feel that much of a Russian threat if they're unwilling to spend even 2% of their GDPs on their military. It comes on the heels of that, and the Trump administration essentially launching an economic war on Europe with tariffs on steel and aluminum and threatening sanctions against European companies over both Iran and European energy companies that would work on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, bringing energy to them from Russia. So at the same time Trump is threatening European countries with economic war, he's demanding that they station more troops in Eastern Europe against the Russian threat. So it's sending kind of a really weird message, mixed message to Europe.
A mixed message, a threatening message, a demanding message. I saw, Mark, by the way, in the Wall Street Journal this morning, the journal reported that the EU countries had sent a letter to the Trump White House acknowledging that their efforts to keep the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear arms deal on track had failed, meaning they were now capitulating rather than to Trump and the threats issued by the Trump White House against European companies that do business with Iran. Here we have Europe being sanctioned, tariffs on Europe, tariffs and sanctions for doing business with Russia. And then Mattis, like, rattling his saber. Public opinion is going to turn. I mean, it's already turning, It's turning all over the world. It's turning against the United States, no?
Yeah, I think the Trump administration is really coming across as both hostile and overbearing at the same time. Like they're trying to pistol whip Europe back into shape, into a position of submission as client states that Trump doesn't seem that they're meeting across, you know, both the economic, the political, and the military realms. I mean, Trump has also intimated, you know, that he would help conservative forces, political forces, get power, be elected in Europe, which the liberal governments, you know, around Brussels saw read as far right forces, right? And that's the way they view governments that have come to power in Italy and Austria, Hungary, Poland, and elsewhere. So it's politics, it's economics, it's military, it's a whole lot of mixed message and confrontation all coming at the same time. And it is definitely a sign of a growing transatlantic rift, and the Trump administration might be trying to paper over that with the specter of a Russian threat and demanding some NATO unity to basically whitewash the rest of what's going on away.
Okay, I want to read a couple sentences from this Newsweek article. We're talking with Mark Sloboda about James Mattis's trip to Europe. Here it goes. Secretary of Defense James Mattis is expected to meet with NATO allies this week in Brussels to discuss ways for several European countries to prepare for combat with Russia, which will include preparing naval and air force for battle. Despite President Donald Trump's friendly rhetoric toward Russia, the plan shows that the administration views Moscow as a serious adversary. It also echoes the administration's official national security strategy, which was released in December last year, and singles out Russia as one of the country's top national security threats. Talk about the national security strategy. Here we have all this anti-Russia gate stuff going on politically, animus being created in public, but the national security strategy is official doctrine.
Yeah, this national security strategy refocused the U.S. Future war strategy away from terrorism in the Middle East and concentrating on Russia and China, which it saw as great power threats to U.S. influence around the world, not necessarily to the United States itself, which is kind of ridiculous. So what Mattis is bringing to the table now with NATO in light of this is what he calls a 30-30-30-30 plan, which is that NATO would be able to supplement its reaction force with 30 battalions, which could be up to 30,000 troops, 30 aircraft, 30 destroyer class or greater warships, all within 30 days of notice. Now, NATO overall outnumbers Russian forces, active duty versus active duty, by more than 2-1. We're talking 2 million collective troops versus 830,000 active duty troops on the Russian side. Now, the whole goal of this is to increasing layers of NATO troops in various formations right up on the Russian border. We've already seen the establishment of air defense and U.S. troops manning these in Poland, in Romania. We've seen the establishment of the NATO enhanced forward presence in Poland, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which comprises up to another 5,000 troops on a rotating basis, as if that somehow excuses them from the treaties that the U.S. And that Russia and the West have signed, which it's clearly illegal under. There's also a very high readiness joint task force, which is another 5,000 troops, again, stationed in Eastern Europe. And this would add up to another 30,000 troops at the same time that Poland is begging the Trump administration that they will pay $2 billion to put a permanent U.S. military base in Poland. And the Trump administration is telling Germany that it wants Germany to buy another missile defense system, the THAAD, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, and put it in Germany. So you have really what started out as more of a political gesture is starting to add layers and layers of formations of NATO troops right up on Russia's border. And they're not just sitting there with them, because there is increasing exercises going on. This week, there is an EPRS exercise, Saber Strike, that actually for the first time involves troops from Israel, with some 18,000 troops, again, right on Russian borders. There was an exercise just in May with 15,000. And there's two more exercises, again, scheduled for the same area, Poland and the Baltics, on Russia's borders, in the coming months, October and November, which will see 35,000 and then 100,000 NATO troops involved in exercises right on Russia's borders. And the last one, the 100,000 troops, involving some 5,000 military vehicles, large numbers of aircraft, and naval craft as well. It's all across the spectrum. That will actually see preemptive attacks being practiced. And that is really worrying Russia.
Yeah, and the Newsweek article calls these efforts to prevent or obstruct or respond to revanchist Russian operations. I mean, it's quite something. We've entered a new period. I think we're past the point of no return, in fact, with the anti-Russia policy. Anyway, this is a big deal. It's a big story. It's a big threat, I would say, to world peace. We've been joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe has requested from Senator Chuck Grassley immunity from prosecution in exchange for testifying in front of a congressional hearing. We're joined from New York City by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Ted Rall, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thanks, Brian.
Why does he need immunity? Maybe we all need immunity, but why does Andrew McCabe in particular seek immunity before testifying?
That's a good question. Well, he knows the answer to that question, and perhaps his legal counsel knows it as well. But one can speculate, and I suppose that's why we're here. McCabe appears to have been a leaker, and he may have violated several federal laws against violating his confidentiality when he talked to the media. He says that he had the right to do so, but he talked to the media about the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server back in 2016. And so it seems that that's the most likely possibility.
Yeah, I mean, it appears that, I mean, Donald Trump or the Department of Justice, after Trump was assailing McCabe for a long time, the Department of Justice fired McCabe like a day before he was to retire. And as a consequence, a lot was made, especially by liberals, that McCabe was being punished by Donald Trump. He's being persecuted by Donald Trump because he was trying to carry out the Russia probe on behalf of the FBI, earlier led by James Comey. Did Andrew McCabe, was he involved in an anti-Trump crusade, as Trump alleges?
I don't think there's a lot of evidence to support that. It seems like, it's certainly, I mean, I've read a lot about this. I think it's very nebulous. I don't think there's much, maybe, but there's, we don't know that. I don't think it's obvious.
The recent Inspector General report found that McCabe, quote, lacked candor, close quote, in his conversations with internal investigators about a fall 2016 story which confirmed the existence of an ongoing probe of the Clinton Foundation during the presidential election. McCabe had said he was acting to defend the Bureau's reputation, and I'm reading from The Atlantic. But the IG report, the Inspector General report, concluded that McCabe was defending himself when he authorized disclosing a conversation with a Justice Department official to a Wall Street Journal reporter, in which McCabe felt he was resisting pressure to slow walk the Clinton probe. Ted Rall, let me try to help our audience understand the relationship between McCabe and James Comey. James Comey was the director of the FBI in 2016, during which time there was a probe into whether Hillary Clinton's use of her State Department work on a personal private email server violated the law. Of course, Comey was blamed by Hillary Clinton, and even today in the New York Times interview by Bill Clinton, for having been partly or maybe even mainly responsible for Hillary Clinton's defeat by having announced that the probe of the Clinton State Department email server, or using it on her private server, had been reopened. That probe had been reopened 11 days before the election. McCabe was there with Comey, but Comey has kind of put a distance between himself and McCabe. And the Inspector General has alleged that McCabe in April misled investigators and James Comey four times, three of them under oath, about authorizing this disclosure to the media, to the Wall Street Journal. In other words, to try to protect his own reputation. While McCabe is being disciplined by the Inspector General, possibly being prosecuted, seeking immunity, and James Comey is now like, well, Andrew McCabe's a good guy, but he's clearly not embracing McCabe. Is it possible, in spite of all of the way this probe seems to be going, that not only McCabe, but James Comey himself could be eventually prosecuted for wrongdoing, including leaking, which Comey has admitted to doing?
Well, it's funny that the short answer is I think maybe yes, although I think politically it would be pretty hard to imagine a prosecution of James Comey. Weighing in favor of that theory is the fact that he has politicized himself. He's written a book. He's done a number of interviews. He's come out as a member of the quote unquote anti-Trump resistance. So certainly that would weigh in favor of it. But on the other hand, he's still a former FBI director, and there would be tremendous pressure. Not just among Democrats, but even among a lot of congressional Republicans against prosecuting him. I think he's probably safe for now, but he is vulnerable politically, and I think in terms of reputationally, in terms of his credibility. Trump quite cannily framed him as a leaker and has pounded away on Comey about the leaking front for a long time on his Twitter feed. And it sounded at the time silly, but it's kind of looking prescient now. And I think that certainly a lot of people are starting to take the leaking side seriously. So what's kind of coming out of this is a lot of members of the quote-unquote intelligence community, but anyway, at the FBI, seem to spend an inordinate amount of time looking out for themselves with a CYA leakage, and not that much time investigating.
Yeah, well, we'll continue to follow to see whether or not Grassley and the Senate actually provide immunity. It's setting up a bit of a confrontation, at least with some lawmakers, certainly with the Republican Party lawmakers who may not want to give McCabe immunity. On the other hand, once they give McCabe immunity, he has to talk, and he'd be talking under oath. I want to turn, though, in our last 2.5 minutes to another point, which I alluded to earlier. Bill Clinton gave an interview to the New York Times, and he said this: "We know that Jill Stein, preferred alternative of the Russians, got more. The difference in her vote in 2012-2016 was more than the difference in the election in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania." So now, and then he blamed Comey a couple questions later for also being responsible for Hillary's loss. But I thought Donald Trump was the preferred alternative for the Russians. Now Bill Clinton, and he's not a maverick. He's with Hillary Clinton. He says Jill Stein was the preferred alternative to Russian. And she made the difference because in the battleground states, Jill Stein, by existing, by running, by getting votes, deprived Hillary Clinton of the coronation. So now it's Jill Stein and the Russians.
First and foremost, that just isn't true. Anybody can look up the results in those three key states and just simply assume that every Jill Stein vote would have gone to Hillary Clinton. And even if that were true, Hillary Clinton still would not have carried those states. She would have carried one out of three. It wouldn't have been enough to give her the electoral vote. So that's what President Clinton said is just simply not true. But the stuff about Jill Stein being the preferred candidate of the Russian government is hilarious. I don't think the Russian government, to the extent that they were vested in the American election, probably took Jill Stein seriously or even thought about her one second. She was an afterthought. She was a very minor candidate. I voted for her myself.
So it's you. Wait a second.
It's me.
Oh, no, you're in New York, so it was inefficient. You should have actually been in Michigan. Yeah, Bill Clinton said the difference in her 2,000 vote, that's Jill Stein, was more than the difference in the election in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. That doesn't mean the Russians did it, but it makes you scratch your head. Yeah, the whole thing makes me scratch my head. Ted Rall, we're out of time. Ted Rall is an award-winning editorial cartoonist. You're listening to Loud and Clear after a short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Nicole Roussel, sitting in for John Kiriakou.
Yesterday, June 5th, was a big day for the midterms. There were primaries in eight states, including five gubernatorial primaries and House races across California. We're joined from California, which had probably the biggest news in most races yesterday, by Natalie Harizi. She is a teacher, librarian, and ran on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket for state insurance commissioner in California and received over 5% of the statewide vote. And we're joined by Kevin Akin, the California state chair of the Peace and Freedom Party, who ran for state treasurer. Natalie and Kevin, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you so much for having me on.
First of all, let's just talk to you, Kevin Akin. You're the state chair of the Peace and Freedom Party. You retained ballot status yesterday as a consequence of having crossed the threshold. Just talk about what happened and why that's important.
We needed at least one of our statewide candidates to get 2% of the vote or more. Three of our statewide candidates did that. Natalie got the most. She's sitting right now at 5.1% with literally millions of more votes to be counted. I got 2.2%, and Mary Lou Finley is in the neighborhood of 4-point-something percent and counting. As I say, there's many more votes to be counted, and our totals will go up. And as we do better in the late-counted votes than in the early-counted votes every election, it means that our percentages will go up slightly as well.
And Kevin, real quick, back to you. Natalie Harizi got how many in terms of absolute votes so far, again, recognizing that they're uncounted?
Well, she's approaching 200,000. I'm sure she'll go over 200,000. And I think it's 180-something thousand right now, and obviously she'll go over 200,000.
Well, Natalie, congratulations. You're not representing the insurance companies. In fact, your campaign called for abolishing them. You are a socialist, and the Peace and Freedom Party is an independent socialist party. Really something, it would seem to me, that 200,000 Californians voted for somebody calling for the abolition of the insurance companies. And of course, well, I would say you ran a shoestring campaign, but that might not really tell the whole story about how under-resourced socialist candidates were here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to agree with you, though, that it is pretty incredible that hundreds of thousands of Californians chose a socialist candidate. And I was calling for health care for every single one, as well as abolishing the insurance companies. And I think it reflects that people in California are very, very sick of living in such a resource-rich state, but not having access to health care primarily, but also to housing, to education. All of the needs that are represented for the people in this state are just not being provided for, and I think that reflects that anger about that. despite a very low turnout. And I also, on the shoestring budget, I mean, we ran a campaign across the state, despite the fact that I am working full time. I didn't stop working to run this campaign. And, you know, we did a lot of fundraising, and GoFundMe still has our funds. They won't release them. Possibly it has something to do with the fact that I'm a socialist. But despite that, we raised funds from, you know, just individual people who wanted to stand up for speaking out for socialism and for healthcare for all and to get rid of the insurance companies. When you say that, people just respond immediately. They understand how damaging they are and that they don't actually provide a service that people need. They're just gambling with our lives to make a profit. So I think we did run a really strong campaign as best we could, and the results show it. And I think, you know, in this primary election, people were excited to be able to vote for someone who wasn't representing the corporations and the banks and was really speaking out against them.
I'm going to ask you, Nicole, in a moment about some of the big takeaways from the primaries yesterday. But Kevin Akin, before I ask Nicole that, I want to ask you about the great fear that the Democratic Party experienced, and maybe rightfully so, because it could be with California's weird top two law that some of the, because the Democratic Party had a crowded field, they're trying to retake the House from the Republicans. There's competitive races in California. But the great fear of the Democrats was that the top two rule in California would perhaps prevent any Democrat from appearing at some of the House races, the general election in November. Why should top two be abolished, and will it perhaps now be considered even by elite parties like the Democratic Party, having seen what's happened? Give us a quick response on that.
People who've already been elected to office, which means the members of the legislature, don't see much wrong with top two because they got elected through it. So if it's changed, it'll probably be changed through a ballot initiative. Both the Democrats and the Republicans got a bit of a scare because under the undemocratic top two thing, if you have, say, two Democrats and five Republicans in a district, and the Republicans in total get more votes, but the Democrats split their votes evenly, it means that each Democrat gets more votes than any of the Republicans, and two Democrats go on the ballot with no Republicans in November. The opposite is true, of course. You can just switch the party name, and the opposite is true. And the Democrats came very close to being excluded in several districts where it looks like they're able to pick up a House seat, but if they couldn't unify around one or two candidates, then the Republicans would have all of the November slots, both of the November slots. It appears that that was averted in most districts. There's quite a few districts which will only have two Democrats on, but two Republicans seems to have been avoided. In the statewide races, Lieutenant Governor is going to just have two Democrats with no Republican or anybody from any other party in November. And U.S. Senate, apparently, it's still a little close yet, but it looks like U.S. Senate also will have only two Democrats, no Republican, as happened 2 years ago.
And we also have a situation, of course, where the Green Party or the Peace and Freedom Party or, you know, any Libertarian Party, all the third parties, if they don't get the top two in the primaries, they're then excluded with the exception of the presidential race. So California voters just don't have a choice in November for so many. I mean, if you're sick and tired of the Democrats and the Republicans, if you don't want to vote for ruling class capitalist parties, for the most part, you don't have anybody to vote for in November. Nicole, let's real quick, because we have a limited amount of time, what are some of the big takeaways from yesterday's outcome? I see there's the Politico says Bernie Sanders' revolution is sputtering because of what happened to pro-Bernie Sanders candidates.
Yeah, Politico and many others were very down on the so-called Bernie candidates yesterday. So he endorsed one person in Iowa, and then Our Revolution, his Sanders' organization, endorsed a couple of others. And so none of those folks won. But that was why a lot of the mainstream media said, well, you know, clearly this was a problem and Bernie isn't popular anymore. But I just want to highlight what I think actually happened is really more about spending than anything else. The former Bernie staffer Pete D'Alessandro in Iowa's 3rd District spent the least of all three candidates and came in last. So these, you know, these things are very clearly correlated. And then for governor, again, Kathy Glasson was a labor leader who was endorsed by Our Revolution. She was running against Fred Hubble, who is a very well-known in the state billionaire who funneled over $2 million of his own money into the campaign for governor. And he spent close to $6 million in the gubernatorial race
money
in
talks.
Iowa.
Money talks.
Yeah, exactly. And Glasson raised more than $1 million, which is obviously a ton of money, but it's nothing close to that $6 million that Hubble had. So she did not win. But I think notably, she got easily the most donations of individuals less than $20. So similar to Natalie Hirisi talking about getting those kind of small individual donations, I think she clearly got more there. So I don't think this was actually any sort of referendum on left-wing politicians. I think it was more a referendum on the fact that when spending is that high, like that's just what's going to happen. You're just going to have those people win.
Yeah, and on Loud and Clear, we're on Friday. Every Friday, we take a look and do a more in-depth analysis of the midterm election. So that's with the Lookman Nation. So tune in on Friday where we're going to look in more for 30 minutes at all of these election races and see if there are discernible trends. Natalie, what about the so-called blue wave, meaning that the energized Democrats are going to take back the House? It looked again like voter turnout from Democrats was about 22%. I mean, it shows that all of this lingo and rhetoric, all of that kind of stuff that we see dominating the mainstream media, the corporate-owned media, the fact of the matter is people still don't really feel, the American people in large measure don't feel that there's a whole lot to vote for. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think the statewide turnout was 21.8% or something like that. And primaries are historically low, but that's a very low turnout. And I think you're right. It really shows that many people, you know, they pay attention to the elections. It's all over the news. It's definitely something that, you know, has people's attention, but it's not motivating people. It's not something that's going to fundamentally change our lives. And I think a lot of people recognize that. And, you know, we've had some experiences over and over again in doing outreach across the state where people are just like, no, you know what, I'm not going to vote. I'm not interested in that. That's not going to change things. I'm really angry. You know, they say these different things. And when we say to them, well, you know, read this, because we're not just asking you to vote. We're talking about how undemocratic the elections actually are, and we're actually going to continue the struggle after the election. They stop and they talk to us and they sign up to get involved. These are not people who are uninterested in what's happening in their lives or uninterested in politics even necessarily. They're just so fed up with the two-party system, the Republican and the Democrats, that are not really offering them anything substantive.
Let's give Kevin Aiken the last word. Kevin, we have just about a minute left. You've been watching Peace and Freedom Party and helping to organize it for a long time. We had the Bernie Sanders campaign in the last election. Clearly, the revival of a more liberal and more socialist sentiment within the electorate, especially among young people. Where do you think things are going? 1 minute.
I think things are going up for socialists. We have much greater public acceptance of the term. I didn't run into very much in the way of revulsion against the term, and I used my entire argument in the ballot pamphlet to advocate for socialism, and so did some of our other candidates. So we believe that we're seeing a greater acceptance of socialism. When more people vote, more people will be voting for socialism. Let me just note also that there are many, many uncounted votes in California. The turnout will actually increase. People who mailed ballots on Election Day will have them counted if they arrive by Friday. So we'll see you.
We'll keep following that. We're pretty much out of time. Nicole, since 1932, no judge has been recalled, but someone was. Anyway, take us out with that, if you would.
You may remember the Stanford rapist, Brock Turner. He only received 6 months behind bars as opposed to the 14 he was eligible for. And Judge Aaron Persky, who gave him that sentence, was recalled yesterday, which is, I mean, just a clear you know, sentence by the people for that judge.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from California by Natalie Hirisi. She is a teacher librarian. She ran on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket for state insurance commissioner in California, calling for the abolition of the insurance companies and a healthcare for all. She's received about 200,000 votes. We've also been joined by Kevin Aiken, the California state chair of the Peace and Freedom Party. Kevin ran for state treasurer. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Turkey and the United States struck a deal this week over the Syrian Kurdish People's Protection Units, the YPG. Turkey has long wanted YPG out of Manbij and threatened to continue its offensive in Afrin, in northern part of Syria, and push it east to Manbij. But this week, the two countries, the United States and Turkey, have agreed that the YPG will leave the area. We're joined from the United Kingdom by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former British ambassador to Syria. Ambassador Ford, this is actually getting to be a pretty big story in the Western or U.S. media, New York Times, Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal even had an editorial entitled Cooling U.S. Tensions with Turkey, subtitle, A Constructive Deal to Stabilize Northern Syria. I'm not quite sure it's about stabilization. But anyway, talk about what's happened.
Well, it appears that there's been this agreement whereby the United States has arranged or is in the process of arranging for the Kurdish YPG militia, which has been controlling the mainly Arab town of Manbij for a couple of years now, since the expulsion of ISIS. The arrangement is that this Kurdish militia will withdraw. And in its place, there's something called the Manbij Military Council, a local militia, which will apparently take over local security control. But there are many gaps in our knowledge. This is supposed to be a three-phase plan with a roadmap, none of which has been divulged. And I rather suspect that it ignores the very obvious point that this isn't American territory to give away. This isn't a Turkish territory to take control of. This is sovereign Syrian territory, which sooner or later will come back under the control of the central government in Damascus.
So the agreement about Manbij, and Manbij is right on the, it's in the northern part of Syria, close to the Turkish border, just to the west of the Euphrates River. And the Euphrates River is a north-south river. It divides between east and west Syria. It's quite something. No Syrians were involved in these negotiations.
It's utterly bizarre. It's surreal that you have these two countries, the United States, two NATO partners, Turkey and the U.S., arguing and apparently agreeing over how to do a carve-up of security responsibilities on a territory that doesn't belong to them, and where they have no right under international law to have any kind of presence. And indeed, one wonders what on earth the United States thinks it's doing in Manbij anyway. ISIS were expelled quite a long while ago now and stands no chance of coming back in that area, which is firmly under the control of local Kurdish and Arab militias who are hostile to IS. IS, anyway, is a spent force, bent only on survival in some pockets, which it still controls in southeastern Syria. So there's not even a pretext of the U.S. hanging around to beat ISIS. There doesn't seem to be any rationale whatever, except possibly to deny territory to Assad.
Yeah, if you look at the headlines, and this is so revealing, if you look at the headlines in the U.S.-owned media, things like Syria, indisputed Manbij, the U.S. and Turkey strike a deal. U.S. pumps brakes as Ankara touts Manbij deal. U.S. ops in Syria enter new phase. Anyway, of course, as I mentioned, the Wall Street Journal, U.S.-Turkey reach deal, cooling U.S. tensions between the United States and Turkey. The obvious imperialistic, and I'm using the word imperialistic not in a rhetorical sense, but just a factual sense, the obvious imperialistic nature of this arrangement whereby, as you've said, Turkey and the United States don't own any part of Syria. They don't have the right to decide what the security arrangement will be in Manbij or any part of Syria. All of that seems to have escaped all the headline writers and the authors of these corporate-owned media outlets. It's not, I mean, it's almost unworldly, almost surreal, except, of course, they all are operating from the vantage point or the viewpoint or the field of vision of empire and of entitlement, not of international law.
Exactly, Brian. This is international autistic behavior, with apologies to people who are on the autism spectrum. But I think you know what I mean. This shows zero sensitivity to human rights, international law, or even self-interest. What do they think they are achieving with this? Carving up other people's territory in Syria's remote northeast, which is of no strategic value. It doesn't even have any oil. I think the U.S. is just responding day to day to issues that crop up. It doesn't have a compass, doesn't have a strategy. It's just a reactive policy. A problem blew up because they'd walked into Manbij a couple of years ago when they were throwing out ISIS with the help of the Kurds. They'd hung around, not quite sure what they were doing. And then a problem emerged up on the Turkish border, and Turkey said, hey, U.S., we're going to walk into Manbij, so either you leave or you hunker down, or something's got to happen. And so for the last 6 months, the U.S. and Turkey have been arguing. It's like two bald men arguing over a comb. They have no right to be arguing about this at all.
Interesting metaphor, and I agree with you. I mean, this is completely outside of international law. Have you been to Manbij? We're talking with Ambassador Peter Ford. Peter Ford was the UK ambassador to Syria. Have you been there? And if so, or if you know of it, what's it like? What are the demographics?
Well, I've been up in that area. It's on the edge of what's been described as the Kansas of Syria. It's prairie. It grows a lot of wheat. It used to be part of what was called the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. It's rolling fields. It's very agricultural, sparsely populated, and it's the majority of the population are Arab. They're not Kurdish at all. So the Kurdish control of Manbij was always going to be tenuous.
And final question, what will the Syrian government, or what can the Syrian government do about this? Obviously, the Syrian government wants to, and actually, weirdly, is accused of trying to reclaim all of Syrian territory by the Syrian government. I mean, that's actually the language in the Western corporate-owned media. Assad trying to regain or recapture or capture or seize. Yeah, that's a good one. Assad trying to seize Syrian territory from hostile forces, armed factions, or foreign forces. What can Syria do?
Well, Syria will, I think, bide its time, first of all, because they will reckon that tensions are bound to emerge out of this so-called agreement. The Kurds won't be happy. The local militia I mentioned is already saying, this is breaking news, we're not going to have any Turks around here. We're not going to stand for a Turkish occupation. So already this thing is starting to unravel. It's going to be messy, yet another mess where there is absolutely no reason for the U.S. to be involved. So Assad will let that situation simmer for a while. Meanwhile, he's quietly getting on with negotiations with the Arab tribes in the area, and in parallel holding talks with the Kurdish leadership. He struck an oil deal with the Kurds because the Kurds control quite a slice of Syria's oil. But economic reality dictates that they reintegrate with the rest of Syria. So Assad will play a long game, I believe, and count not least on the emergence of a situation similar to what happened in Iraq, where U.S. forces were attacked by the local Sunnis. I'm happy that they'd installed the Shia in power in Baghdad, and that caused a couple of years' warfare in Iraq. And we're beginning to see in the U.S. Occupied zone of Syria this same situation emerging. The U.S., in fact, is already bombing Arab villages in the northeast of Syria where the locals have refused to be conscripted into the Kurdish-dominated militia. It's a big Iraq-style mess.
Yeah, a fragmentation of a formerly unitary country, again, by the feckless, reckless, and illegal intervention by foreign forces, including the government that speaks in our name here in the United States. We've been joined from the United Kingdom by Ambassador Peter Ford. Peter Ford is the former British ambassador to Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, defended the Trump administration's policy of separating families at the border, saying, quote, if people don't want to be separated from their children, they should not bring them with them, close quote. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona, by Isabel Garcia, co-founder of the Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Isabel, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Brian. Thank you for talking about this important issue.
The UN says forcibly separating parents and children is a violation of fundamental rights and that it's a violation of international law. Here you have the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, cavalierly saying to parents who are trying to survive and keep their families together, oh, don't bring your kids if you don't want to be separated from them at the border. I mean, you can't get more cruel, more callous. You just published an op-ed on this. Talk about what you said, you and your co-writer.
Well, we are a coalition and a community in Tucson that has for years seen the dramatic growth of the prosecutions of illegal entries, and we talked about that before. It's an outrage. It's over half of our criminal prosecutions. Now, this administration has decided to impose a zero tolerance in terms of illegal entry, right? So if you enter anywhere other than the port of entry, and mind you, we have stories here of people, you know, being held 7 days at the border, 7-10 days, and then they try to go through a gate or something, and they're charged with illegal entry, first-time entrance or second-time entrance or whatever. They're holding a zero-tolerance policy. Imagine, and then they claim that it is dictated by law. That's not true. The prosecutorial discretion that has gone on in the offices of the U.S. attorney and starting with the administrations, I mean, are long. Prosecutors cannot possibly go after every criminal case. And let me tell you, I graduated high school in 1971, and we have yet to reach the levels of migration that we saw in 1971. And yet, where you are and in the rest of the community in this country, everybody thinks we're being overrun by immigrants. And instead, what's going on, I believe, is that we are punishing Central Americans for coming into our country and really becoming the evidence of our meddling and interfering and everything you call it, the destruction we've created in Central America and helped to create, continues to today. Honduras could not allow a second presidency, and because the U.S. said that president is now president, even though the Honduran people documented the fraud, said this is unconstitutional, and so we have, you know, a situation in Guatemala that's now even worse with the volcano, but the repression by those governments, El Salvador, and so now these people are coming forward to save their lives, to save the lives of their children. And when they say, why don't they stay in Mexico? What did Mexico do to Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador? Other than, yeah, it carries the lunch for the U.S. It does try to impose immigration policies, but at the behest of the U.S. And so for them to then say, you know, how dare they come to the U.S. when that's the only thing they can do? Imagine, what would you do? What would make you bring your child to these treacherous and unknown conditions? It has to be sheer desperation and love and all of it. And for us to violate international law, I mean, that the United Nations has to step up to say that the best interest of the child is always the most important thing. Do you know the damage that we've done to children that have been separated already? That traumatic experience, we've talked to child psychologists that are members of our groups, and they have all expressed an outrage that these children are being separated and we are committing like torture. This country is committing torture on these children because the physical separation of a child, imagine at 7 years old, at 18 months, at 4 years, with parents getting up in the courtroom and saying at this point, you know, nothing about, they don't care right now about the political asylum claims, even though that's what we've been documenting. Right now, what they're clamoring about is, where's my child? And that no one can give them an answer immediately, not the judge that is presiding in this really elaborate court that some immigrants have described as a huge cathedral, that we have these men and women in power and that they tell them, we don't know where your child is. Can you imagine what that must feel like as a parent?
That's the voice of Isabel Garcia. Isabel Garcia is talking to us from Tucson, Arizona. She's involved in helping and defending the rights of immigrants at the border and in a border area. Isabel Garcia and Dino DeConcini have written an op-ed called We Must Speak Out Against Immigrant Family Separation. Isabel, I was shared on my own Facebook pictures of these young kids sleeping, and they're literally locked in cages. I mean, it's very disturbing, graphic imagery. But those pictures were also taken, I believe, around 2014, meaning this didn't start just with Trump, although the policy, the zero tolerance policy, is different. The Obama administration actually went to court and successfully went to court arguing that children who came across the border, I'm not talking about children who came across with the parent with their parents and then were separated, but children who came across as children by themselves did not have the right for a court-appointed attorney to represent them in immigration proceedings. And the Obama administration argued, even in the case of a three-year-old, that three-year-old should not have a lawyer. It was like shocking. Talk about what that policy is and what's new about the Trump policy.
Well, what we've always talked about here for decades is that we have to understand that both Democrat and Republican administrations have really created this horrific situation, right? Yes, it was Obama. I visited, along with Congressman Grijalva's delegation in Nogales, when they had these kids literally caged. This was under Obama administration. And it's horrific. I mean, how can we allow this? But the difference now is that Sessions and Trump have decided, we're going to punish you. If you bring your children up, if you come with your children, if you come at all, if we catch you, we're going to charge you with a crime. And that's why the spokesperson I heard yesterday say, no, well, anybody that's charged with a crime anywhere in the United States can't take their child in. Yes, that's true. But they're the administration that decided for the first time to do this as a matter of policy, to separate children from their parents as punishment. We have never seen this before. We have not seen this. They're lying when they say that, because even though the Democrat administrations have created atrocious conditions, including financing the growth of this military-industrial complex that's at the border, the growth of Streamline and the prosecutions, yes, they're all responsible. However, it's this administration that has taken on really this immoral position to say migration, even though it's caused by us or we've had a role in it, migration is now going to be a crime. And you who are coming from those countries that we support militarily, those very governments that are suppressing you, you will not be allowed to come in and taint the body politic in the United States.
Yeah, that is a difference. And it violates the basic laws regarding asylum, right?
Yes, it does. Yes, I mean, I'm going on a broader, you know, argument here. But yes, they're violating international law. They are violating national law. They're violating treaty rights. I mean, we are violating the very basic human norms that we pride ourselves with being champions of, to violate that very, very bond between a parent and a child in a violent way by separating them, with Border Patrol agents just looking on indifferently, and the attitude of all of them, Nikki Haley included, all of them are saying, you know, it's the law and that's what we do.
That's Isabel Garcia. She's the co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Isabel's talking to us from Tucson, Arizona. We're talking about the policy, the zero tolerance policy of the Trump administration that makes every undocumented person, no matter what reason they're coming for, what level of desperation, what basis they may have to seek asylum, treating them as and treating them completely as criminals, and also insisting as a matter of policy that their children be taken from them, that they be separated from them, and that they be put in prison away from their parents. And also, we have U.S. government officials making statements like this: it's no big deal if the parents and children are separated, because something will happen with the children. They'll go to foster care or whatever. I mean, unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. It really takes your breath away. And that, you know, the American Immigration Council, we cite that in our op-ed, they reported that, you know, almost 640 parents were separated from almost 660 children in just 13 days in May.
Just this May, 13 days, 638 parents separated from 658 kids, their children.
In our first 2 weeks here, we had 24 parents saying, we have children, where are they?
Yeah, and you have Jeff Sessions, these callous, racist, bigoted officials who are inhabiting and dominating the Trump administration, saying, no big deal. If they didn't want to have their kids separated and put into prison, they shouldn't have brought them with them. Well, what exactly were they supposed to do with their kids? What exactly were they supposed to do?
Yeah, what's the family values, right?
The right to life and family values, except we're going to put your kids in prison. 45 seconds left, Isabel. What do you want to tell the people in this country?
I think we need to wake up to what our administration is doing and how much money it is spending. Remember, we are not being invaded by the South. I am almost 65 years old. I graduated in 71, and we have yet to reach those levels. So we need to wake up and stop spending our money on the prosecution of illegal entry when we've allowed, you know, we've turned to Obama, said, oh, we're not going to prosecute you. That took us down in the economic meltdown, and on and on and on. We give passes to so many people. Oh, let's not go down that route. And yet, when there is a possibility of discretion with these children. They're taking the acts and migrants that we're causing, they're taking the exact opposite.
We're going to leave it there. We were joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia, a strong voice, a consistent voice, representing undocumented families, and in this case, undocumented children who are being locked up. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can subscribe to us as a podcast at iTunes or at iHeartRadio, and you can also hear us every day at SputnikNews.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. See you next time.
Loud and Clear.